Well, good morning again. Please do join me in having Romans chapter 3 open in front of you. You'll find that extremely helpful. I'm currently on holiday from being a teacher, as been mentioned, so I'm just going to take us back to my familiar territory. And there are three people sitting outside the head teacher's office, that dreaded place. They're waiting for a meeting to happen. One of them, the child of the three, they're looking particularly anxious. The other two people, the parents of the child, they look both anxious and annoyed. So you hang around to see what happens. After the meeting, they all walk out of the head teacher's office and they head back home, and that child has got their head down. They're just looking at the floor and they look ashamed now. The parents, they look let down and embarrassed. There's been a permanent exclusion. There's been behaviour from the child that cannot be allowed to continue in this school. It's got no place here. And so exclusion was the only option available. In Romans chapter 3, we have an exclusion. In verse 27, Paul's writing to a local church, not a school. There are people in Rome who are, they now have this shared hope in the Saviour Jesus Christ. They are sinners, and they know it. The law of God has told them they are sinners. They've been told that Jesus is a rescuer for sinners. And so they trust him, one by one, and together they trust him. They're a church. And in writing to this local church, Paul tells them something needs to be excluded from you as a church. And it's boasting. Verse 27. Boasting is to be excluded from any local church. There's no place for it. It's not welcome. Can't continue. And in thinking about that exclusion this morning, we're going to ask three questions. Firstly, why ask about boasting at all? Why go here? Then, mainly, why is it excluded? Why has boasting got no place in the local church? And then finally, how does the church behave when boasting has been excluded? So firstly, let's ask together, why ask at all about boasting? Paul says, where is boasting then? Why? One preacher has called Romans the greatest letter ever written. It's a letter about the gospel, and by that Paul means good news from God about his son. And at this point in this letter, chapter 3, it's a major turning point in Paul's writing. After painting a really dark background of sin, chapter 3, verse 21, but now, something new, something different, good news is now on the scene. Righteousness. From God to sinners through the work of Christ by faith. Martin Luther calls this part of Romans the very centre of the Bible. So why then here at the centre of the gospel, at the centre of the whole Bible, we could say, why does Paul say, where is boasting then? Where does that come from? What makes boasting the issue to write about here? I think the answer is that Paul knows who's going to read his letter, doesn't he? He knows that people will read it. And people, all of us, have a bias, a leaning towards boasting, don't we? It's just the way that we lean. And we have that bias towards boasting because of sin and because of religion. We boast before God and before people because of sin. The heart of sin is me wanting to be like God. Independence from God at the centre of my own world. Thank you very much. Supreme in my own universe. That's the heart of sin. And so pride is at the heart of sin, isn't it? And pride produces boasting. Pride is the fire of boasting. In our pride, I compare myself to you. And being the sinful person I am, I will boast. if I feel that I'm doing well in that comparison, I'll start to boast in subtle ways. This is why I think I'm superior in this comparison. I'll talk about the things that I feel proud of, that set me apart from you. If I do that comparison and I feel that other people, they're coming out better than me, in my pride, I still boast. I boast about the things I mention, the things that I wish you would notice about me. I really should come off better in this, and I'm going to mention those things, whether it's my achievements or just people that I know, a connection I have that makes me look good, or something that I think I'm achieving. We boast because of sin. We also boast because of religion. Religion is a self-made attempt to achieve acceptance with God. I'm going to build it up by myself. And religion is like petrol to the fire of boasting. They go dangerously well together. My own attempts to change my behavior, my attempts to build up this status before God or before other people. And it all serves to further ignite our boasting. We might feel spiritually superior to somebody else, and so we boast inwardly or with our mouths. We take the credit for the spiritual fruit that we're showing. If things aren't going well spiritually, we feel the need to cover it up, and so we boast. Paul knows that local churches full of people reading this letter, they'll have some sort of issue with boasting before God and with each other. And so he points out here a major, massive implication of his news that he's telling. This boasting, it's got to go. It's excluded. Secondly, let's ask why then? Why is boasting excluded? Verse 27, Paul answers that question, doesn't he? Where is boasting then? It's to be nowhere. But why? Why no place for boasting in a local church? In chapter 3, verse 21, as we said, but now, here comes the change. Here comes the news from God about his son. And after saying this news, he then says, well, where then is boasting? You see, boasting is going to be excluded because of the news of the gospel. The truth you find in the gospel will be truth that will push boasting out. Whereas the petrol of religion, it caused boasting to burn all the more. The water of the gospel will put that fire out. So looking at verses 21 through to 26 of this chapter 3, we're going to learn three things in the gospel that lead to the exclusion, the putting out of boasting. So first, in the gospel, we learn that we are all as bad as each other. We're all as bad as each other. If Paul has made one point in this letter so far, it's this. The whole human race before God is wrong. And he pulls no punches in describing me and you in this letter. Cast your eyes down verses 10 through to 18. Unprofitable, that's me. Lying, bitterness, misery, open tombs, poisonous snakes. That's my heart and your heart before God. Our sin before God is a very ugly reality. So when we learn that God's son died in our place, it's not so much to think, look how much I am worth. Look at the value of me here. But rather, look how far we have fallen. It caused God's son to go there. And Paul's point is very clear. We are all as bad as each other. This church in Rome was a real mix of Jew and Gentile, which would be a recipe for strained relationships then as now. In chapter 1, Paul has described the sin of the Gentile world. So surely then, they are the worst. In this local church, they stand out as the worst of sinners. Paul said it in chapter 1. Then in chapter 2, though, Paul exposes a different layer of sin, the hypocrisy of the Jewish nation. So maybe they are the worst after all. In this local church in Rome, it's the Jews. They're the worst sinners. But chapter 3, verse 9, both Jew and Gentile are all under sin. Verse 19, Paul has every mouth stopped. No one speaking. The whole world is seen as guilty before God. And so, verse 22, there is no difference. Why? For all have sinned and all fall short of the glory of God. No difference. In a local church, everyone is as bad as each other. Already there's some cold water, isn't there, for the flames of boasting. And you do start to feel slightly superior to somebody else. There is no difference. Actually, that person is far worse than you realise. But then so are you. We have no grounds at all, do we, for boasting before God. Nothing to point to in ourselves. And so, no comparing yourself to somebody else in the church and coming out better. There is no difference at all. We are all as bad as each other. The second thing we learn in the gospel is this, that we are all, every member of a local church, are all made righteous in the same way as a gift received by faith. In the good news of the gospel, there's a stunning change of status. Later on in the Christian life, there is a change of behavior, but in the gospel first, there's a stunning change of status before God. In verse 21, Paul starts to write about the righteousness of God, but verse 22, not coming against people, as it should do, but to people. He talks about the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. So verse 24, people are justified. Sinful people are announced to be righteous. Declared to be in the right, even though they're wrong. A Christian wakes up every morning with a status before God, righteous. But Paul wants to be very clear. That's not something achieved by anybody in any local church. This righteousness from God is a gift. Verse 24, he says, being justified freely by his grace. That word freely there means without being paid for. That word grace there means without being worked for. No payment and no work. Paul wants to be understood very clearly. This gift from God, there's no cost from you and there's no work from you, from any of you. It's as a gift. Verse 22, it's to all who believe. Verse 25, it's through faith. Verse 28, it's by faith apart from, nowhere near, deeds of the law. It's not about your doing. You receive it. There is no achieving on our part before God. Instead, all the achieving is done by Jesus. Verse 24. Being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God set forth as a propitiation by his blood. There's the work. It's by Jesus. This gift did come at a great cost. It did come with great work, but it's not yours. Christ died, Paul says, as a propitiation, taking, absorbing to himself the very wrath of God. It was achieved for us, outside of us. And we receive it as a generous gift from God. So no boasting here. Verse 27, by what law? Of works, of things that I've done? My achievement? No, says Paul, by faith. And crucially for Paul, in this local church at Rome and here, every member receives that gift in exactly the same way. It's the same faith for all of us. Verse 29. Is he the God of the Jews only? Is he not also the God of the Gentiles? Yes, of the Gentiles also, since there is one God, who will justify the circumcised by faith and the uncircumcised through faith. The same faith for both. Were the Jews in this local church a special case? Could they look down on their fellow Gentile Christians? No. God justifies, makes righteous both groups with the same faith. And the same goes for my local church at Bury and this local church here. Every member has been made righteous gloriously in the same way, through the same faith. No achieving, no working, no deserving. It's empty hands and faith for all. No difference. And so, no boasting. There's one more thing to learn here. In the gospel, the main issue in salvation, we could say the biggest issue in our salvation, was about God, not about us. Verse 25. Whom God set forth, Jesus was set forth, put forward as a propitiation by his blood through faith to demonstrate his righteousness. Because in his forbearance, God had passed over the sins that were previously committed. Paul writes about the main action in salvation here. It's Christ going to the cross and dying. The question to ask is why? Why did he go to the cross and die? There are many answers given to that question, aren't there, in the New Testament? Christ died to demonstrate God's love, to demonstrate his own love, to achieve forgiveness, to bear wrath, to take away guilt, to take away a curse. But what was the main issue that God was dealing with as his son died on the cross? What was the main issue? Verse 25 tells us he did this to demonstrate his righteousness. Isn't that interesting? I'm not there at all as the main thing. Christ went to the cross to demonstrate something about God. That God was just. That God was righteous. Why was that demonstration necessary? Isn't it obvious that God is righteous and just? Verse 25 says, no, it's not obvious. Because in his forbearance, in his patience in the past, God has passed over sin. God has been leaving sin unpunished. There have been animals that have died, but that's got nothing to do with really dealing with sin. Not sin that tramples all over God's reputation day after day. Sins of the heart that want to rob God of his supremacy. Sin that shouts out in the world every day, God's glory does not matter. But people are called out to him with that sin for mercy, and they trusted in a sacrifice to come, and God had looked at their sin and passed over. Really? Abraham? A liar? A coward? God declares him righteous, really? King David? An adulterous murderer? And God forgives his sin just like that? What does that say about God? Does sin not matter? Does God not really care about his reputation and his glory as he should? Does God not care about justice? This is the main issue in salvation, isn't it? It's about God. How can he pass over sin? The main issue is not really about me. As ugly and as offensive as our sin really is against God, God's grace is more than a match for our sin. God's great desire was to forgive his people, to make them righteous. As Paul says, to justify those who have faith in Jesus. But the issue is his justice in doing that. His righteousness. Because to be righteous, God must take sin seriously, mustn't he? To be just, he must deal with it. He can't just pass over it. So what does God do? The gospel God puts forward his own Son as one of us. And he gladly lives on our behalf. And he willingly takes our glory-trampling sin to himself. And in him, on the cross, God dealt with it. Finally, fully, nothing held back. And so, for all the universe to see, God is righteous. God is just. Because in Jesus, sin that shouts offensive things about God's glory was smashed. Yet his people, they're spared. God remains just. Yet in the process, his people are declared to be righteous. Isn't that wonderful? Verse 26, to demonstrate at the present time his righteousness, that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. Here then is more cold water for the fire of boasting. Christ on the cross is the very center of salvation. There God demonstrates his love in giving us his Son. There Christ demonstrates his love in bearing our sin. But supremely, there God demonstrates his own righteousness. He upholds his own reputation. So again, it's not so much, look how much I am worth, but look how much God's glory is worth. His Son died to uphold it. Yes, at the cross, we're made innocent in the clear, but ultimately, God was clearing his own name at the cross. For our good and for our joy, God is at the center of our salvation, not us. And so he should be. So again, no boasting here. No placing of myself at the center, even of my own salvation. We are all as bad as each other. We are all made righteous through the same faith. And when it comes to this salvation, it's God who's at the center. Where is boasting then? It's gone. It's excluded, isn't it? So finally, let's ask our third question, which is, how does a church behave then when that boasting has been kicked out? And for this, could you please turn to Romans chapter 12 with me? Romans chapter 12. This chapter in Romans marks another major turn in the letter. Paul will now get down to practicalities. Your day-to-day life in a church family, in your own family, at work, in the society that you live in. In the light of the gospel message, here is a description of living that out. And because the gospel leads to the exclusion of boasting, here will be then a description of church life with no boasting. Perhaps you're not making that connection between boasting before God and boasting before people in life. We can see maybe that the gospel clearly excludes boasting before God. But that's different to life in the church, isn't it? We come to God humbly, not boasting at all in ourselves, but life with each other, that's a different story, isn't it? I don't think it is. The two are connected, aren't they? If the gospel makes me lose my pride before God, it makes me lose my pride before you. If I should stop boasting in my relationship with God, I should stop boasting in my relationship with my fellow church members and family and friends and people that I work with. Boasting should be gone. And we find that in Romans 12. The gospel will change the way we are in all of life. So let's just look very briefly through these instructions here for church life in Romans 12. And let's just find five brief descriptions of church members who are living out this truth that boasting has gone. Five brief descriptions. Number one, we see church members here who don't think too highly of themselves. Verse 3. For I say, through the grace given to me, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. So Paul's got in mind here church members in a local church without an inflated opinion of themselves. The gospel message has given them real perspective. They are no more special, no more important than anybody else in the local church. These members don't assume then that everyone should agree with them all the time. They'll listen to what other people have to say. They're happy to ask for advice and help and to be vulnerable in that. These people are not easily offended. How dare you say that to me? No, because boasting is gone. They don't think too highly of themselves. Secondly, Paul writes about church members who are happy to use their own gifts. Verse 5. So we, being many, are one body in Christ, and individually members of one another. Having then gifts, differing according to the grace that is given to us, let us use them. Paul's writing about members of a church content with the different gifts God has given them. Some of them might be a gift of serving in the church, or teaching, or giving, or leading, or showing mercy. And Paul tells different members of the church, use your different gift, but use your gift. When you see your status before God as a staggering gift in itself, to then also be given a gift, a role of serving somewhere in his church, that gift's even greater, isn't it? These are not members restless, looking at the gifts and the position of other people in the church. They're happy to play their part, because their pride has been put out and their boasting has stopped. I'll play my part with my gift according to the grace that God has given me. Thirdly, in verse 10, church members who look for the honour of others, not themselves. Verse 10, be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honour, giving preference to one another. Having been set free then from thinking too highly of myself, I can now look, can't I, for the honour of other people, for their preferences. These church members, they're not looking for attention for themselves all the time. They're happy in a conversation for the conversation to fall on someone else, about them. I don't have to bring in things to do with me. They can see other members and their circumstances as more important than their own. And so, look down to verse 15. These members, they can rejoice with those who rejoice, even if their own circumstances are difficult at that time. I can drop my own circumstances. I'll rejoice with you. I'm not better than you. And also, they can weep with those who weep, even if they themselves are rejoicing. I can put down my rejoicing for now and weep with you, because I'm not more important than you. I'm not better than you. There's no difference. These are members who are quick to notice the grace of God at work in someone else. Not their difficulties, not the things that still need to be worked on. They want to see what God's grace is doing in somebody else, for their honour and for God's glory. And they're quick to point that out to other people, not to gossip about their failures. Fourthly, Paul describes church members who happily mix with people that perhaps other people wouldn't. Verse 16. Be of the same mind towards one another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Proud people find it so difficult, don't they, to mix with people different to them, or to mix with people that they couldn't boast about spending time with afterwards. I mean, you never guess who I was speaking with before. Guess where I'm going for lunch later. Proud people find that so difficult, don't they, to spend time with someone that you couldn't boast about afterwards. No one would be interested in what you have to say. These members are willing to, aren't they? Their mind's not on high things. They associate with the humble, with the lowly. They're not trying to maintain their own image in a local church. They're not worried about how someone else will make them look. There's no looking down on someone because there's no difference. They'll accept people where they are and they'll live life with them. They'll talk with them. They'll eat with them. Fifthly, Paul describes church members here who will respond to attack with patience and practical good. Verse 17. Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it's possible, as much as it depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, for it's written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Proud people find it so hard, don't they, to respond well to attack or to criticism. How dare somebody treat me in this way? I deserve better. I've earned a better reputation than this. There's an anxious need in some people, isn't there, to be seen to be right as quickly as possible. The record must be set straight immediately. Maybe gossip is responded to with more gossip to make sure that you keep on looking okay. But not these members. Instead, they respond with patience. They look for an opportunity to show kindness to the very person who's at them, who's against them. They'll leave a situation with God, won't they? To his perfect vengeance, Paul says. They're not clambering to fix a situation themselves. They'll do their part in keeping the peace because they're not proud, because the gospel has excluded their pride and their boasting. Now, reading through these descriptions in Romans 12, this much is clear to me. I really need to change. There is work to be done in me. I see embers of pride that are still burning in me and flames of boasting that spring up here and there in conversation. So when we find this pride and this boasting, as subtle as it may be, in ourselves, this wanting of things to go my way, for my reputation, what must we do? What must we do? That's really the wrong question. We're not to do anything, really. We're to go back to the news of the gospel. What has God done through his Son? Because it's that truth that will kick out my pride again and exclude my boasting. We are worse than we know and as bad as everybody else. We are given a status with God more staggering than we yet realize. And we receive that status in the same way as everybody else, by faith, the same faith. And at the center of our salvation, it's not me, but God and his honor and his reputation. So talk about that gospel story with yourself. Talk to yourself about it. Talk to each other about it. Don't use Christian jargon so that it just sounds the same as you've always said it, but use down-to-earth, everyday words that you would normally use to talk about what has God done, because that will kick out your boasting and your pride. We need to hear it, don't we? The same news. And then we need to apply it to each other. This attitude that I have, this pattern of behavior that I see in myself, it must be changed by this aspect of the gospel. So let the message of Christ then, let the gospel dwell in you as a church here. As you speak to each other and sing to each other the gospel news. And look to God to change your heart by the power of his Spirit.